Gnashtish, thank you for being here with us today. You are listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. The U.S. House race and ranked choice voting seem to be sucking up all the political oxygen, while a measure that asks voters to approve a constitutional convention is just not on their radar. So at this point, there is no way to know whether this lack of attention might lead voters to be more likely to approve it or defeat it. But if this measure passes, it could open the door to some big changes for our state and perhaps some unforeseen consequences. That's why I've invited two people who do have their eye on this ballot measure: Tim Bradner, publisher of the Alaska Legislative Digest, who also specializes in natural resource reporting, and James Brook, who recently left the Anchorage Daily News to report for the Alaska Beacon, a new online publication. Here's my recent conversation with Tim Bradner and James Brooks about what could be at stake. Well, James, I'd like to start with you because you've put on a new hat. You are now working for the Alaska Beacon, which is an online publication, and it's kind of like an all-star team of journalists, some of the best of the best that have been recruited. And so I imagine that working there gives you a chance to do some deep dives that you might not have had a chance to do in the past.
Well, and how I tend to think of it is as a free version of the Associated Press. Our job is to cover things that regular newspapers, radio stations, TV stations might not have the time to address because they're focused on topics that are local or the highlights. And so we can spend time developing other stories, and then we release them for free, and those radio stations, TV stations, and newspapers can pick them up and use them and share them with their readers. And our goal is to make it additive, not subtractive. We don't want to duplicate what's already being done. We don't want to be a competitor. And by releasing them for free, releasing our content for free, we feel like we can help people rather than be a competitor.
Well, my dad always said there's no such thing as a free lunch. So who's paying for lunch?
Right. And the interesting thing about this is that it's a nonprofit. It's donation funded. So if people are reading their newspaper, watching their TV station, listening to their radio, and hearing our name, if they think that's valuable, they'll donate to the Alaska Beacon, and then it'll allow us to keep going.
So who provides the seed money?
The seed money came from States Newsroom, which is a national nonprofit. It's the parent agency. And there are newsrooms, nonprofits like the Beacon all throughout the country, covering capitals throughout the country. And the goal is to have one of these in all 50 states so that there is a core of independent, donation-funded journalists at each capital. And since it's donation-funded, there's not a large financial interest that's steering coverage or has the potential to.
Well, it's interesting that sometimes we have to depend on sort of journalism outside the mainstream to delve into issues like the Constitutional Convention. Well, Tim, you have an interesting background, too. You wear many hats. You produce the Legislative Digest, but you also have hosted interviews with lawmakers on KTOO's 360 TV and worked in various publications as a natural resources reporter. Why do you feel like the Constitutional Convention ballot measure is really important to take a closer look at?
Well, it's kind of a sleeper issue. A lot of people aren't really aware of it, haven't paid a lot of attention to it. Under the Constitution, it comes up automatically every 10 years. We have to vote on it. It's on the ballot automatically. But we just haven't heard that much about it this year. A lot of people were thinking that this might be a year where they'd be more interested in it. People talk about putting a permanent fund in the Constitution and things like that. So that may still develop, but we haven't really heard a lot about those sort of things so far. And I think it's a really important issue. If it ever actually happened, it would be something that would open up the whole state constitution to revision. You'd have a convention that would be elected, and there's been some rough estimates put together as to what that would cost, but it would take a couple of years for that convention, the delegates that would have to run. It's not clear, and it's probably likely that legislators could serve. So the Constitutional Convention would probably look a lot like the current state legislature. It can open up a lot of things, like rewrite fish and game laws, natural resource laws, education, really foundational statehood issues, like the management of our fisheries, sustained yield is in the Constitution. I mean, that could be opened up. Subsistence could become an important issue. All sorts of, you just don't know what's going to happen. And that's why I think people don't understand it, don't understand the implications. And that's why I think every time it's been on the ballot so far, except for the first time it almost passed, it's lost heavily. Just because I think people, when they don't understand the implications or they worry about the implications, they vote no.
So why might this time be different, or will it be different? You know, we have a lot of things on the political landscape this year, from ranked choice voting to the election of a U.S. congressman.
I think it's different this year because there are interests at play that see an advantage in having a convention. For example, if you're opposed to abortion rights in Alaska, a convention is the most straightforward way to make abortion illegal in Alaska, because right now the Alaska Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled that the state's privacy clause in the Constitution protects abortion access. You could theoretically amend the Constitution to change that definition, but amendment attempts have repeatedly failed in the legislature. They just haven't gotten enough support. So if you throw that issue to a convention, anything could happen.
Well, isn't the Constitution by design set up so that it is hard to pass a constitutional amendment?
It is, and a convention is a lot more straightforward. It's a lot more open-ended.
But what's the wisdom of making it hard to pass constitutional amendments, Tim?
A constitutional amendment is a big deal. You know, once it's in there, it's very difficult to undo. And the Constitution is the final word on law. The legislature can always change a statute. Once it's in the Constitution, it takes another amendment to change it, or a constitutional convention.
James, you mentioned some of the people that are interested in this passing, and it looks like the abortion issue is driving it. What other issues are out there?
Abortion is probably either number one or number two. The issue that it's competing with is the issue of the permanent fund dividend, how much should be paid each year, and whether that payment should be guaranteed and not set in statute. As Tim mentioned, the legislature can override statute. Right now, there's a payout formula in state law, but each year the legislature passes a state budget, and that itself is a state law. One state law can override another. And so each year since 2016, the legislature has set a dividend payout amount different from what is in the law setting the formula for payouts. And that's legal. The Supreme Court has ruled as much. But there's enough dissatisfaction with that way of doing things that there's a significant push to say, let's put a formula or a payout guarantee in the Constitution itself. Amendment ideas haven't gotten anywhere. And so because this is a perennial issue, there's a significant amount of interest in kicking it to a convention saying the legislature is deadlocked. It can't solve it on its own. So send it to someone else. Send it to a convention and have them resolve it. And the stakes are pretty high on that because this is a multi-billion dollar issue that would affect the future of the Alaska Permanent Fund, the $80 billion fund that now funds between half and two-thirds of the state's services. And so it's a big, big issue.
Two hot political potatoes, so to speak.
Wanda, if I could add to something to what James just said, that particular issue affects not only the permanent fund, but also the state budget, because right now the permanent fund helps support the state budget with an automatic payout fund where the fund contributes a part of its earnings. As a matter of fact, 60 to 65% of the state's general fund budget is now paid by the permanent fund and only 30% by oil. But the amount of the dividend could eat into that. If you set a formula, and this all gets very complicated, but if you set a formula for the payout of the dividend that's unusually generous, shall I say, it could eat into the amount that the permanent fund can afford to pay to support the state budget. That puts pressure on state services and indirectly puts pressure on that we need to have taxes, which some people think is a good thing. But anyway, it's a complicated deal. It's a big deal. I frankly am a little surprised that I haven't heard so much. It may be a sleeper issue, but I think the fact that there was a big dividend this year may have taken some of the wind out of the sails of that. What do you think, James?
I'd agree with that, Tim. I think we'd hear even less if the even larger dividend that was proposed but failed, because that didn't happen. I think that there could have been even less momentum, but I do think that the amount that was paid this year has definitely taken away some of the momentum from that issue. It doesn't mean that issue is going away, of course. Next year, we're already looking at lower oil prices, and next year's dividend is almost certainly going to be lower without some significant change in this year's election or some other factor coming up.
So you fix some problems with the Constitutional Convention, maybe the things that some groups are advocating for, like banning abortion or enshrining the permanent fund dividend, but you cause other problems. And there's a long list, but maybe each of you, could you talk about some of the potential unintended consequences?
Unintended consequences? Are you thinking other issues?
Well, just things that people may not realize could be affected by this. I mean, Tim kind of gave an overview earlier that there's a huge basket of issues.
There's two that are on my mind. One that I heard at Southeast Conference down in Ketchikan earlier this month. And Senator Jesse Keel, who represents Juneau, had said that he thinks the first thing to go would be Juneau as the capital city. The Constitution lists that in transition language. It's not a strong constitutional protection, but his thought is that if there is a convention, that's one of the first things to go because there are potentially so many representatives to the convention that are coming from outside of Juneau or outside of Southeast and would be interested in changing that. Another thing that's caught my attention that I'm interested in is a rural subsistence preference. Right now, for hunting and fishing, you can't prioritize under the state constitution rural residents over city residents. And the Federal Subsistence Board takes up that issue and tries to implement a preference as best it can. If you amend the constitution, you could theoretically change that and give rural residents a preference in hunting and fishing, give them more hunting and fishing rights. The legislature tried in the 1990s really hard to grant that. They couldn't come up with a compromise. That amendment failed. In a constitutional convention, that I would expect would come up again.
If I could push the door that James just mentioned a little wider, I think it could go the other way too, because I think urban sports groups could sense that same opportunity to rewrite foundational fish and game legal structures and really try to erode rural subsistence rights, I mean, what little there is in state law. And I think that would really set up a much more serious confrontation with the federal government because the feds do guarantee subsistence rights on federal lands. But I could easily see that happening. As much as rural folks would like to reinforce subsistence rights and rural rights, I can easily see a counterbalancing momentum coming from urban sports groups who are very politically active and very well organized. And will certainly want to get their delegates elected to the Constitutional Convention if it happens.
Yeah, and as controversial as we've seen fish and hunting politics, there's going to be a push-pull between subsistence, commercial, and sport on those issues. I think Tim's absolutely right.
It's interesting that some Native groups think it might be a good idea to revisit the Constitution, and other Native groups don't think it's a good idea for exactly the same reasons, Tim, that you just mentioned, that it could give sports hunting groups the upper hand in determining how subsistence resources are allocated in our state. What about Native organizations and sort of the split feelings about this?
Ron, one issue which I'm a little bit familiar with is education in rural Alaska. But if I can set the stage for that by just mentioning that there was only, as Vic Fisher has and Willie Hensley have mentioned to me, that there was only one Alaskan Native delegate to the original 1956 Constitutional Convention. Vic Fisher, of course, is a well-known Alaskan. He's one of the sole remaining Alaskan who was a participant in the 1956 Constitutional Convention. Jack Coghill, the other longtime sole remaining survivor, passed away 2 years ago. But Vic has very strong feelings about provisions of the Constitution, that particularly the local government chapter that he was very much involved in. Willie Hensley is a well-known Alaskan Native leader, is also one of the remaining few people who were really the leaders of the Native land claims movement and were key players. There's not many of those guys left, but Willie is still with us, as is Evil Naughty and a few others, but not that many. But Willie remembers what life was like back before oil, and we had a lot of oil money. And I can't speak for Willie, but I remember some discussions where there's a feeling that rural interests have been kind of underrepresented. There was no mention of land rights, Aboriginal rights. There could have been, there should have been, but there wasn't. But, you know, there's no mention in the Constitution of Aboriginal land rights or Native land rights, for example. Looking back, a lot of people think it's a real oversight.
And if I could interject, too, if you read the proceedings of the convention, they come across, some sections come across as particularly racist, given modern standards. There was extended debates over literacy tests on allowing people to vote who could not speak English or could speak English. Where did they draw the line? And the original Constitution did include a literacy test and required people to be able to read English. That was later taken out through the amendment process because of federal court rulings that said literacy tests are illegal.
So, boy, there's a lot of history and baggage that probably the average voter is not going to know about.
Absolutely. And this Constitution was written in the 1950s during the Red Scare. There were a lot of debates about loyalty to the United States. And
hence we have the debate over a legislator's ties to a radical right-wing group.
Yeah. And at the time, the writers of the Constitution were concerned about loyalty to the Communist Party and left-wing groups. And now we're seeing that show up in ways that I don't imagine the framers were intending.
Yeah, there is a lot of baggage in the Constitution, and people would argue it certainly could have been done better. But I've also heard, and I don't want to pretend to be any kind of an expert or certainly any kind of constitutional scholar, but I've heard that our 1956 Constitution was kind of a model Constitution because it was the first new state constitution written in many years. Alaska attracted a lot of attention. A lot of scholars and academics came to help us write a model constitution that's very streamlined and really one of the most efficient, considered to be one of the most efficient in the country. For example, we have, for better or worse, we have a strong executive where all the authority and all the responsibility is vested in one branch of government and one person, the governor.
Well, I remember Walter Hickel saying that the governor is effectively the manager of the ranch. Do you remember that?
But in most other states, that's not true. You have elected attorney generals, elected dog catchers, elected revenue commissioners who campaign. And you can just see all the complications that creates. Here it's very simple. The governor appoints everybody.
Well, and you brought up the point about elected dog catchers. Here, we don't have elected judges. The framers of the Constitution were very deliberate about not having elected judges, that there's a merit selection process. And that's something that a lot of Republicans I've spoken to are interested in changing that. They feel that this is a Republican state. The governor should be able to just pick Republican judges, or Republican judges should be able to be elected.
So I guess opening up the Constitution could shift political powers potentially.
It certainly would make government more complicated and less transparent.
Well, one of the things, too, that I've heard Alaska Native groups say, that structure that you just talked about where the executive branch has a lot of authority is colonial. It's kind of a top-down model, and it kind of leaves them out of the mix in the decision-making process, or it has historically.
And Rhonda, I think where you see that feeling exhibited most directly is in the realm of education, because the feeling is that the education system is driven from Juneau with an urban bias, non-native bias. I mean, that's sort of exhibit number one that people in rural communities who might support a constitutional convention would say.
And I think a lot of views on whether there should be a convention or whether there should not be a convention come down to whether somebody is an optimist or a pessimist and whether they're a gambler or not, because this is a gamble on a process if it's a yes vote, because you'd have a vote for delegates and then those delegates would meet and then there would be a vote on the final product as well. We could very easily end up with a process where if Alaskans approve a convention, that we might be left in uncertainty for 6 years and then end up with nothing for it and be right back where we started.
Do you think potentially that this could be divisive for the state? I mean, some could argue it would.
Yes. Yes, it already is.
It would open up a lot of years of uncertainties. We'd have to have the election of the delegates. I can see a lot of large companies that want to invest in Alaska would really hesitate because they could worry that the tax laws would be rewritten. By the way, I just can't let this go by without mentioning that I'm going to demonstrate my short breath of American history, but as I recall, our original National Constitutional Convention was a bit of a runaway convention itself. Those guys went to Philadelphia and they closed the doors and they rewrote the whole thing. They did not follow their instructions from that, whatever that thing was, that loose confederation of states. Yeah. And they came out with a different document. And we can all go watch the musical Hamilton again, and we can see echoes. But anyway, that was case number one of a runaway constitutional convention was our founding document, I've heard.
Yeah, and whatever comes out of the convention has to be approved by voters before it becomes an active document. So I've heard the argument that, well, there's an off-ramp if there is a runaway convention in this case. In that case, it was up to the states to ratify, and so there was a bit of insulation between the voters and what actually happened.
Well, in wrapping things up, what are your parting thoughts that you'd like to share with voters about what they should be thinking about as they head to the polls?
Well, my shot would be there's a high probability that your current legislature is going to look a lot like a constitutional convention. So look at that as a model.
And my thought is that a lot of the convention is going to be dictated by the legislature. In 1970, Alaskans did approve the Constitutional Convention question narrowly. That question was later overturned by the Alaska Supreme Court as being misleading, and a revote took place 2 years later, and that vote overwhelmingly turned it down. But in those 2 years, we got a little window of what might happen, what things might look like if the convention question passes. And in those 2 years, we saw the Alaska legislature debate intensively about what a convention might look like, where it should be held, who should appear, and what the topic should be, how it should be organized. And if that question passes this year, I'd expect to see the same thing, high probability again of the vote being challenged in court. And then once that's all done, you've still got to elect delegates. Those delegates still have to meet. You still have to approve the final product, and we're talking about a multi-year process. Even if the question is approved, there's no guarantee of any solution.
Everything always boils down to timing. It's always the best of times, the worst of times. But why might this be a good or bad time to revisit the Constitution?
I'd say it's a good time because the legislature is deadlocked. I'd say it's a bad time because we're extremely polarized right now, and a convention would be debating the very things that we're most polarized over.
I would agree with James. You know, people talk about the permanent fund dividend issue every year, sucking all the oxygen out of the legislature so that nothing else really substantial gets done. And I think this would just add another major elements sucking all the oxygen out of the room in the legislatures. If this does pass, and they, as James says, they have to debate how they're actually going to do it. So I think it means that for probably at least two years, legislature will be preoccupied with this and the perennial PFD issue. Good luck with getting anything else passed of substance.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you for joining us, Tim Bradner and James Brooks. Thanks for weighing in and giving us an overview of all the complexities, all the moving pieces. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rhonda.
Well, the timing of my conversation with Tim Bradner and James Brooks couldn't be better, because Alaska Public Media is hosting a debate on the Constitutional Convention tonight at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium in Anchorage at 7. KTOO's 360 TV will air a tape delay broadcast of this debate at 8:30 tonight. Alaska Public Media's news director, Lori Townsend, will moderate the debate, which will feature questions from a panel of journalists representing Alaska Public Media, the Alaska Beacon, and the Anchorage Daily News. And debating on the pro-convention side are Bob Byrd, chairman of the Alaskan Independence Party and host of Talk of the Kenai on KSRM Radio, and former Alaska Lieutenant Governor Lauren Lehman. Representing the anti-convention side are Joelle Hall, president of the Alaska AFL-CIO, and Matt Shukaro, the owner of Fathom Strategic Communications. Once again, 360 TV will air a tape-delayed broadcast of tonight's debate at 8:30, and on the radio side, the debate will be aired at a later time on KTOO FM 104.3.